You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 30. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about wildlife conservation issues from all across the globe. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. And that was the last time you'll hear our special Vaquita theme song, an original tune from Ben Mearen composed using actual vocalizations of the Vaquita porpoise. Today, on our final Vaquita-themed episode of this month, we're talking with Lorenzo Rojas Baracho. Despite the warnings of some of his graduate advisors, Lorenzo has truly become Mr. Vaquita. He is the head of marine mammal conservation and research for the National Institute of Ecology and Climate Change in Mexico, and he has dedicated more than 20 years of his life to saving the vaquita. Lorenzo has a fascinating perspective on vaquita conservation, and it's particularly interesting to hear about how the social and political system in Mexico has shaped this issue. Lorenzo has had many struggles in his efforts to teach both policymakers and the general public in Mexico about this species. One of his greatest challenges was simply convincing people that the vaquita actually exists and hasn't yet gone extinct. Let's jump into this interview and hear from Lorenzo. I am here with Dr. Lorenzo Rojas Baracho, who is the head of coordination for marine mammal research and conservation at the National Institute of Ecology and Climate Change. How are you doing today, Lorenzo?
Fine, Matt. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show. My first question for you is, I want to get just a little bit of background. I'm wondering how you first became interested in marine mammal conservation.
Oh, that has a long story.
Let's hear it.
Well, as many of my generation, I was a little kid and I saw TV programs about whales and dolphins. Those were in Mexico. And besides the Cousteau program, there were other nature-based programs that I really enjoyed. And then I had the opportunity to visit SeaWorld in San Diego years ago. And I just fell in love with the animals. So I started first as a marine mammal trainer. And then I realized that I was not happy seeing animals in captivity. So I decided to go to school, study biology, and tried all the time to work one way or the other with marine mammals. So we had a professor from Chile who had been or was an expert in large whales. So I did my bachelor thesis with fin whales from the Gulf of California. And then from one to the other took me finally to vaquita when I was doing my PhD. Several people had an influence in me getting to vaquita. At that time, Bob Brownell was the head of protected resources at the Southwest Fisheries Science Center. And then he was an expert, had been concerned about vaquita, so he was a big push in my life. And Andrew Deason, who was the head of the genetics lab also. And I went once to meet someone that I didn't realize we're going to be working together for many years. And it was Barb Taylor. She was doing her PhD or finished her PhD. At that time, I went to her office trying to find out how to use genetics to come with arguments for conservation of vaquita. But also, we didn't know at that time how many vaquitas there were. So I was trying to approach this from genetic side, because at that time we were thinking that surveys with boats were not working properly. So anyway, that's more or less how I got into marine mammals and then vaquita.
Fantastic. Yeah. And Dr. Barbara Taylor was our guest on last week's episode of the podcast. And she told the same story about her first meeting with you and how that sort of inspired her to become involved in vaquita conservation. So it's neat to hear your side of that interaction as well. How long ago was this? How long have you been involved in vaquita conservation?
Vaquita conservation, that's always a tough question. I think I started... Originally, I was doing my PhD thesis on humpback whales. So it was when Bob Brownell came to the lab in La Jolla when I kind of shifted to vaquita, and also a professor in Mexico also told me that it was ridiculous that nobody was working with vaquita. So probably that was early 90s, I think, and we had very little idea of abundance of vaquita. Threats were being discussed, and I it must have been 91, 93, about those years.
Okay. And so you mentioned that very little research on the vaquita had been done before that time. I mean, why do you think that is? Why is it that up until this point in the early 90s, no one had really taken too close of a look at this species?
Well, there were strong and we knew a little bit about the life history of vaquita. I mean, there was Omar Vidal, who's now with WWF, who started doing the first efforts in Mexico, and Catarina de Agrosa, who estimated the bycatch in the, I think it was also early 90s. But at the same time, it's not an easy animal to work with. It's not like dolphins that you see them leap out of the water or approach boats. They're kind of shy, so it was difficult to approach them. And people try different ways to estimate the abundance of vaquita. And they use small boats and sailboats, even air balloons, whatever you can imagine. And nothing seemed to work. And I think people were getting discouraged about being able to study vaquita. And they were more concentrated in efforts and sometimes about behavior, which is very hard to work with. But what we needed was estimates of abundance and population trends. And that's what I was more looking at that. And it's expensive to do a population survey. I mean, it's in the order of $3 million. So it's not a money that everybody has to go out and do a large ship survey. And so finally, at the end, thanks to Team Gerardet, we started to understand better the abundance of vaquita, and to Jay Barlow, who's Barb's husband. And I think that kind of triggered more research, and I was fortunate enough to get enough samples of vaquita that were bycaught in gill nets. And those vaquitas were used in a way to study biology and life history of vaquita, and I was able to do some of the genetics. So I think it was a group of people getting involved and started pushing research, even with the minimum resources we had at that time.
Gotcha. So, I mean, you mentioned as well in there that there was no good population estimate for the vaquita at that point in time when you first started working with the species. But I guess I'm just wondering, like, what your sense at that time of what was going on with the vaquita porpoise was. I mean, were you worried that this species, that these species numbers, you know, that the population numbers were very low? Were you concerned that they could be declining at a rapid rate? I guess I'm just looking for sort of a general picture of the concern that you had for this population.
Yeah, I at that time we did, even though we didn't have exact estimate of abundance, I was an observer in many boats or many surveys or in oceanographic cruises and covered the whole Gulf of California. Started working those boats probably late 1980s. And I mean, you could see a bunch of marine mammals, large whales and dolphins, sea lions, but we saw very little vaquita. So it was clear to me at that time that something was wrong there. So many surveys, so many people going to the Gulf to do marine mammal surveys, and we had very little sightings of vaquita. So it was clear that it was a scarce animal. And at that time, I think Jay Barlow and Silvers did some aerial surveys, and the density of animals was very low. I think it went from 2 to 7 animals per every 1,000 kilometer, which, if you compare that with a harbor porpoise in California waters, that was like 47 animals per 1,000 kilometers. So we didn't have the abundance estimate, but it was clear that something was going wrong. Years later, while I was at the lab in La Jolla, Jay Barlow and others published the first abundance estimate. It was kind of an opportunistic estimate. They were doing a large cetacean survey or marine mammal survey in the Gulf of California. They got to the upper Gulf. They had nice weather, and they were able to do some transects or to look for vaquitas. And they estimated at that time the population, I think, 224 or 225 animals. So it became very clear now at that point, having all those set of data, and that the genetic diversity was very low, that something was really wrong. And I was proud, and I'm still proud, of course, that Mexico has done a lot of work to prevent the extinction of marine mammals. So elephant seals were at the brink of extinction, and the Mexican government was the first government to protect them. We had also Guadalupe fur seals were down in numbers. There are many circumstances played also an important role to recover these fur seals, but in a way, Mexico protected those. We had the first whale sanctuaries in the world for the breeding lagoons of gray whales. So in my mind, it was impossible to think that we would let the only endemic species of marine mammal in Mexico go extinct. And I had been taught at that time, when I was a student, that the problem with the vaquita was the lack of flow of the Colorado River. Basically, that meant that because the water of the Colorado River was diverted to urban and agricultural uses, and mainly in the U.S., then that meant that there were no nutrients coming into the upper Gulf, so the productivity of the Gulf was very low. And that was how I was educated. But then when I started working on genetics, I had about 35 or 40 vaquitas that were bycaught in gillnets and that I used for my PhD thesis. So it was like, Jesus, I don't see how the Colorado River is going to play a role here, because vaquitas had full stomachs, they look healthy, they were not emaciated. So everything, and then I talked to oceanographers in the US and Mexico, and everybody agreed that there were many mechanisms in the upper Gulf to bring nutrients to it, even if there was no river. So I concluded that, well, there's something wrong with this. And at that time also, I had a call from who was the director of the Fisheries Institute in Mexico, and they were responsible for marine mammals in the 1990s. And he called me to his office, and he wanted to talk about vaquita. So I gave him my views, and I was writing a paper about risk factors on vaquita, and Barb Taylor and I wrote it together and published that one. And we had concluded that the only risk factor that was going to drive vaquita to extinction was bycatch in gillnets. And Dr. Antonio Diaz de Leon, who was the director of the institute, said, "Okay, so what should we do?" And I said, "I think the best is if we have an international recovery team with world-known experts from the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Mexico, and we go through what we know of vaquita and see what we agree and propose the recovery plan." And so he gave me green light. It was not an easy people. Many people opposed. I mean, for most Mexicans, that's not true. For many government officers in the federal government in Mexico, particularly the fisheries sector and other groups, they wanted to blame it to the Colorado River because there was a way to blame it to the U.S. So if vaquita goes extinct, it's a U.S. problem. It's not our problem. And so we created this international group with US scientists, and as I mentioned, from Europe and Canada. We looked at risk factors and what we knew about vaquita biology, and we agreed, and everybody agreed, that the main risk factor and the only risk factor that might drive vaquita to extinction is bycatch in gillnets. And so we started working then on a recovery program and how to we could ban gillnets. But anyway, the whole answering your question, I was feeling so bad about Mexico losing this unique species that I got involved in more than I thought I was going to get involved. I remember Oli Ryder, who was one of my PhD committee members, told me, Lorenzo, don't become Mr. Vaquita. That's not good for you.
Well, you know, I'm happy that you did not take that advice to heart, because you've over the years have done, you know, some really important research on vaquita and played this central role in these conservation and recovery efforts. You know, I wanted to sort of bring up this, I guess, this interesting point that. That Barbara Taylor mentioned in our interview with her, and so you were just talking about sort of this discovery that this discovery of what the real cause of the decline of the vaquita was, or you know what this factor is that could be driving a decline and a potential extinction of the species as this bycatch issue. And it's fascinating to hear sort of the debate over that, and you know that sort of desire to blame the issue on the issues relating to the Colorado River, which I mean makes sense, right? I mean, without sort of that that research that you had done on bycatch, you know that would seem like a very believable hypothesis. But anyways, this point that Barbara Taylor brought up is related to sort of this discovery of how rapidly the vaquita population was declining. And she explained that it wasn't until this remote acoustic monitoring program was set up that a true understanding of how rapidly the vaquita was declining came, you know, was sort of realized. And you know, I asked her this question of like, what was the, you know, what's the biggest surprise that you've had in your research with vaquita? And she said it was, you know, and it surprised me that she said this, that, you know, her biggest surprise was seeing that 18% per year rate of decline when the data started coming in from the remote acoustic monitoring program in the Upper Gulf. And I guess I'm wondering if this was as big of a surprise to you as it was to her. You know, I mean, what was, did you have a similar reaction to this research from the acoustic monitoring program coming in?
Yeah. When I, as I was saying, doing a vaquita survey, it's really expensive. I mean, both time and observer was really expensive. So we were looking at an option that would be cheaper and we could do it as precise as possible. So it came with doing a monitoring in acoustic way the vaquita. So I guess Barb probably explained that. But anyways, detecting vaquita makes noises or clicks to find food, and we can take advantage of those clicks to detect vaquitas. So I have to say that most of the vaquita research, or all of the vaquita research, has been a teamwork in which Barb has played a central role, but so other colleagues like Jay Barrell or Tim Gerardet at the Southwest Fisheries and Science Center. And we made a cruise to try different acoustic equipment and see which was the one that worked best to detect vaquitas. And we had Nick Traganza from the UK and Tom Akamatsu from Japan. So we tried all everything, and finally we found these, what we call C-pods, which seems to work great. And we started doing the research, and we could see actually what triggered probably the most important conservation factors in the early days was, as Armando, who is a fantastic acoustician and very smart biologist that works in my program, his PhD thesis was using acoustics to detect population trends. And he called me once and said, Lorenzo, look at this. Population is going down badly. And I said, well, let's call the minister right now. And I think at that time, I can't remember the figure, but about 8% per year, the population was declining. And it was already a shock. It was a big shock. And we called the minister at that time of environment and explained to him what we have. And that's how the first vaquita refuge started. It was a smaller area than what we have now. And that was my first shock to see that, that the population was declining that bad. But then many of the boats, there was a recovery program to reduce fishing effort and get many nets out of the water. And as we were doing the acoustics, the population seemed to decline less faster, but still was declining. And so that was my perception. Like, we went from 8% to about 5 or 4% decline. It was, okay, we're not doing perfect, but it's better than what we were. And when we finally had the first data set of a larger acoustic monitoring program that we put 40 to 60 acoustic detectors in the main area of vaquita concentration, we sat down in La Jolla in a lab there, and we formed what we call the expert panel, which is our top scientists worldwide that were able to help with the statistical analysis, mainly spatial statistics, because we had lost some equipment to illegal fisheries. So we got some gaps in our data set. So these friends came and we all worked 3 days doing the modeling. And when the number came out of minus 18.5% per year, I've never felt so bad in my life. I was thinking there's something must be wrong here. We have to redo things. And now people look at it, the experts and Armando went through the exercise again, and it was 18.5%, so it was 37% per year in the last 2 years, which was 2014 when we had that info. So it was a killer. I remember closing my eyes and putting my hands in my head and said, Jesus, well, this is not good. We were not supposed to be at this where we are. And I was thinking myself, what happened? What happened? That have we done things wrong, or something must have happened? And certainly, one of the explanations was the illegal fishery for Totuaba that exploited in those years, because the prices for the swim bladder, that we call it here buche, raised to over $8,500 per kilo. So everybody went fishing for Totuaba, and the problem with the nets used for Totuaba is they're about the size, the mesh size is about the size of a vaquita head. So they get entangled very easily. And some of the worst kills of vaquita during years was gill nets for Totuaba. So it was really depressing, actually.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what that must have been like. I mean, and it sounds to me like you were in a position at that point where you thought you had been seeing some of the fruits of your labor, right? You thought that the data you had up until that point was showing that rate of decline was decreasing, that, you know, these steps that had been taken already setting up the vaquita reserve were really having an impact. And then to get those results back and see that, I can't even imagine.
It was damn horrible, and it was even worse to realize that when I started working or got interested in Vaquita, Totuaba was the killer of vaquitas. And then back to the basics, years later, there were again with Totuaba illegal fishery going, swim bladders going to China. I mean, when I was starting my thesis, Omar Vidal sent me a list of vaquitas bycaught, and he registered, I think, 77 vaquitas that were bycaught in Totuaba gillnets between 1983 and 93. And that at least 130 or 128 vaquitas were killed from 85 to 92. And from those, about 65 or 67% were killed in the Totuaba fisheries. That was when I was starting working with Totuaba. And then here we are years later, exactly in the same situation. There's the Totuaba, it's illegal. It's the China market again. It's hard to explain, and as you say very clearly, my mind and our mind, I think most of us, was that we hadn't stopped the decline of vaquita, but we had reduced the speed of decline of the population size.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about how this Totuaba fishery has been an issue for so long, and that, you know, even when you were just starting your work with vaquita, that was probably one of the biggest threats to vaquita populations at that time as well. I mean, do you think that has always been the case, and it's just that we didn't realize how great of an impact it's been having until recently? Or do you think that there was sort of a lull in the demand for Totuaba, and that it has sort of, that demand has sort of skyrocketed recently because of what's happening in China and the fact that those swim bladders are getting so much money in that market?
Oh, I think gillnets, the real Totuaba fisher was long before I was even born, I think. And when we started working with vaquita, there you could always see some Totuaba gillnets. I mean, it's really hard anywhere in the world probably to ban completely a fishery. So there was a little of Totuaba here and there, but it was not a big thing. And one of the papers that Barb and I wrote, I think my second paper, we estimated how many vaquitas might have been killed in Totuaba gillnets. It was like 52 vaquitas per year, which was the highest rate. And we took all the historic data for vaquita fisheries, and this was done from an experimental Totuaba fishery by the fisheries department, which was a pretty dumb thing to do, by the way. But then the whole thing declined. I mean, we were in the water, we went out to do field work, and you saw very little nets. And I think what happened is that China drove extinct at least one of the species that they used to use their swim bladder for, this medical or medicinal soup that they use, the Totuaba swim bladder. And I can remember the name, I think something like Baja Baja. And they needed something to substitute that. And so they came down, and I mean, Chinese have been in Baja for years, and so they knew for a long time. And actually, fishing towns in the upper Gulf, like Santa Clara and San Felipe, were founded because of the Totuaba fishery. So I think it exploded in some time. The Chinese market needed that. There was a big demand. I mean, there are records of soups, a plate of soup costing about 10,000 US. So I think it was the demand that was this explosion to have vaquita swim bladder that hit us badly. So in other words, yeah, it was more of a recent thing. I mean, certainly, as I said, we always had some records or reports from some illegal fishing here and there, but nothing like what happened 2000 and the end of 2011, 2012, 2013. Probably still now, what we know is the swim bladder price has gone down, but still very high, 5,000 US. That's the last one I heard. So still a lot of money if you've got several Totoabas.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to learn about the nature of this Totoaba fishery over time, you know, and you know, for example, I had no idea until you just told me that these two coastal towns were actually founded, you know, based around this fishery for Totoaba, you know, probably long before this fish species was declared endangered and it became illegal to fish for them. But yeah, it's interesting to learn about the history of this fishery and how, you know, these interactions between the fishery and the wildlife in the region. And it's certainly a complex relationship. So I'm curious to learn about some of the political issues that surround vaquita recovery in Mexico. I'm sure that in your role as the head of coordination for marine mammal research, I'm sure politics plays a role in that, right? I'm sure that there's a lot of sort of, you know, communicating a lot of the research that's going on relating to vaquita to folks that are involved in policy and trying to make sure that, you know, the best sort of political decisions are made to help protect the vaquita. I guess I'm wondering, you know, what the process has been like in order to get this this 2-year gill net ban implemented.
I think there were several things. When I started working with vaquita, my surprise was not only that there was a denial to bycatch by many government officers, and again, federal and state level governments from Baja California, Sonora, and the government of Mexico, and of course by the fishery sector, and even researchers denied the bycatch problem. But my surprise came when I started to realize that they were denying the very existence of vaquita. So when I started, for many, the vaquita never existed, or if it existed, it had to go extinct. So when we started working with that, and thanks also to the very good work that Omar Vidal and Lloyd Finlay's group started doing in Sonora, we had some data, but we had first to convince people that vaquita existed. And so bad that we had to do a special cruise just to film vaquitas and take photographs of vaquitas. Which, by the way, when we presented that in a meeting with fishermen, one fisherman told me that's Photoshop. And I said, well, if it's Photoshop, I should have, I need to have a vaquita from somewhere. And he said, oh, it's probably plastic. So anyway, that's how we started. And it's been a long time, but then, I mean, it was clear that it existed. I mean, for many people, of course, it existed, but it was just this official position for many persons from the fishing sector that thought that it was easier to deny the existence of vaquita, and then you got rid of the problem. So we went from there to the existence of vaquita, then to the acceptance that there were low numbers, because vaquita research took so long to develop. And I mean, by now, probably vaquita from the most critical endangered marine mammal now in the world. But we know more of vaquita than we know for many other cetacean species that are much more abundant. So I think we know more of vaquita than probably any other critical endangered marine mammal species by now. But to give you an idea, when vaquita was discovered, then we didn't know how even vaquita looked like. It was not till, I think, mid 85, 87, when it was described, and we really knew how it looked like. People had not seen them. They are so shy, and they spend so few seconds in the surface that people doesn't notice them. So, I mean, there was some kind of justification to say that they doesn't exist, and those that were bycatched, they will just throw them away or bury them or whatever. So those animals, we had them in labs, and people didn't see them. Here is a story for you, and I will not mention the names, but some time ago, the person who was named by the president of Mexico some 10 years ago or more. He was the head of agriculture and fisheries. And of course, he was denying the existence of Vaquita. So at that time, we recovered one of the most beautiful vaquita we ever recovered. I mean, it was completely fresh. Like, it looked alive. I mean, the colors and beautiful animal, a female. And it was huge. It was a bit longer than 1.5 meters. And we sent it to Mexico City. So they would present this vaquita to that Minister of Agriculture and Environment. And what, at that time, one of the officers in the government did, which certainly was not welcomed by the minister, they were in a breakfast in a restaurant. So they brought the vaquita in this, I don't know how you call that, it is charts or, no, where you carry the desserts.
Oh, sure, a platter, yeah.
Kind of a platter, but yeah. They have wheels and then you push them and...
Right, right.
So they put the vaquita there and covered it with a piece of cloth. And they offered him dessert and then they took the cloth out. It was a vaquita.
Oh my God.
And he got extremely angry. I mean, he just really got pissed off. But that made the point that vaquita existed. And that... We were in the need of urgent action. So then, I mean, at that time, the international recovery team called CIRVA was doing very good work, was recognized widely for their good works and recommendations. And we started slowly, very slowly. As I said, first agreeing that the main threat for the vaquita was bycatch. Then we started proposing to ban gill nets. That took years. So because we couldn't ban gill nets, then we were given this vaquita refuge at least to protect it for... It was just an interim measure. Let's have this area to protect vaquita, the main area of vaquita concentration, so we have time to develop alternative fishing gear and socioeconomic alternatives for fishermen, because it certainly is not fair to save vaquita and send fishermen to extinction. So we had to work with the vaquita and with the fishermen. And that it was very hard to get economists to agree to work with us. It was, I went so many meetings to try to convince economists to work with us. And they said yes at the beginning, but once they knew it was isolated towns with very bad freeways, no fresh water, and I mean, they lost their interest. But at the end, we got some very good economists, Enrique Sanjurjo from World Wildlife Fund and others. And so we started doing some of the modeling to find some alternatives for fishermen. And then came a very important program, which is called the PASE, which is the recovery program for vaquita. PASE, it's a recovery program for many species in Mexico, but the first one implemented was the vaquita. And so that started working. It really brought new energy to vaquita conservation. They didn't ban gill nets, but at least they banned them in an area. The main strategy from the program was to buy out fishing gear and fishing license and compensate fishermen with that. And once you gave them money, you or some of the funds, then you will help them to build up a business. And some fishermen went to and opened cyber cafes or... small hotels. It was a bad moment because the U.S. economic crisis hit hard in the U.S. and of course less tourists came down and it was complicated for many fishermen to make a living under those circumstances not fishing. But anyway, so some have been successful. And then the other strategy was to compensate fishermen not to fish within the vaquita refuge. That was the hardest And I think the worst part all the time and the weakest part for vaquita conservation has been enforcement. And so, we lost a lot of equipment, of our acoustic equipment, to illegal gill nets. And then from there, it jumped to, I think, the most important aspect of all was when this new government that it's now in power created the Presidential Commission of the Presidency of Mexico for the recovery of vaquita. I think that really changed because then we had a forum where we could present all our work. In the past, we just sent it by memos and art. We publish articles and send them to ministers, etc. But this time that we all sat in one place, and it is when we found out that the population was declining, and we called for an urgent emergency measure to ban gillnets throughout vaquita distribution. It was the exclusion zone for vaquita, and now here we are with a gillnet ban. But I mean, the whole process was difficult. I was threatened several times by fishermen, by fisheries authorities. One wanted me in jail because anti-Mexican activities, which I don't know why what that meant really. But I thought I was doing something for my country. So it was. It came through a hard process, but these authorities have taken very seriously. I mean, the president of Mexico was in San Felipe to launch the recovery program. That had never happened.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a really hopeful step to me. The fact that the president was there to announce this program, this 2-year ban, the fact that your efforts to convince the government to implement this emergency 2-year ban, which I understand, like, under normal circumstances, there would be a whole review process to go through before implementing something like this, but they were able to, you know, call this an emergency action and get it started much sooner. This all seems very hopeful to me, right? But I mean, the looming question is, I mean, you know, is this enough? You know, is this enough to save the species? You know, even if enforcement is really good within the region.
No, sadly, I mean, certainly it's very positive to ban gillnets for 2 years. It's an emergency measure, but 2 years would not give time to recover vaquita, and we don't have the scientific instruments and methodology to detect a change in vaquita abundance down or up in just 2 years. I mean, vaquita produce a young every 2 years, and even in the most optimistic cases, you might add in those 2 years 4 or 6 vaquitas, and we have no way to detect that. So there are two things there. One, there's no time. 2 years is not enough time. You have to ban gillnets permanently if you want to save the vaquita. There's no doubt about that. So that's something that has to be very clear. So again, in the recovery team, we said very clearly that survival of vaquita will depend on a permanent gillnet ban. So 2 years is a good start, and we hope that that will give opportunity during these 2 years to develop more alternative livelihoods for fishermen, including more alternative fishing gear. I mean, we have alternative gear for shrimp, and we never were able to test properly this alternative gear because this is a small-scale trawl to fish shrimp, and gillnetters would block the fishermen that accepted to change to this alternative gear. So they were never able to use it properly. They were boycotted by gillnetters. But now that there are no gillnets, there will be time to improve the shrimp gillnet fish alternative gear. It's a fantastic time to develop alternative gear for finfish, which we don't have. And although this is not very clear in the recovery program, I think that's going to happen. So my guess is that if this happens, if we have this new gear, it will be an opportunity to expand this ban from 2 years to permanent. And it will be also a good moment to find alternative markets for finfish and shrimp from the Upper Gulf. I mean, chefs worldwide are... they want tractability and sustainability in their kitchens. And this is a golden opportunity to make this happen for fishermen in the Upper Gulf to sell their products as vaquita safe products.
Fantastic. So, yeah, it sounds to me like even though this emergency 2-year ban that's been set up is not a permanent solution, it is something that will hopefully allow you and all the other folks who are involved in vaquita recovery efforts to have the time that is necessary to put together a permanent solution to the issue, which was absolutely necessary, right? I mean, if this 2-year ban hadn't gone into effect, you wouldn't even have that time to figure out, you know, what needs to be done and to develop this alternative, or to sort of prove the effectiveness of this alternative gear and develop this market for, you know, sustainably harvested seafood from that region.
Yeah. I mean, it's an unprecedented measure, and certainly it's a signal of times changing. And I'm pleased with that. And also, the Fisheries Department has been more helpful than in the past. So, I mean, it's the Fisheries Department who developed the alternative gear for shrimp, and they're working together with NGOs to develop the alternative gear for finfish. So, in that way, I think we are all very optimistic about it. Now, enforcement, and this is good news, we've been monitoring enforcement in a way with many other groups, and there are aerial surveys, and I just received the report today in the morning before you called, and they saw only 2 pangas, and they were not fishing. They were close to coast, and 2 weeks ago they had only 2 as well, and from our monitoring we haven't seen pangas going. Pangas are, sorry, the artisanal fiberglass fishing boats for fishermen without outboard motors. We haven't seen pangas go out from San Felipe. So it seems like this new strategy that this government implemented, which was have enforcement be in charge of not 1 or 2 agencies, but 7 agencies working coordinately. So you have the Navy, you have part of the Army, you have the Fisheries Department, the Attorney General for Environment, Federal Police. It's like 7 government agencies working jointly. So that seems to have been working. I mean, there are no pangas out. So if that continues this way and you expand the ban permanently, I mean, we are in very, very good shape to save Vaquita. And I think very important to me as Mexican is this would be a big, big success and signal from Mexico worldwide. Bycatch is the worst and the most dangerous threat to all marine mammals worldwide. So having a success story will, I think, encourage many other governments and many other groups to do what we are doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're able to establish a framework for the recovery of the vaquita that is effective, then that's going to be hugely beneficial information for other groups, yeah, all around the world who are dealing with similar issues related to gillnet fishing. So yeah, it's fantastic to hear, and it's really amazing to hear about how effective the enforcement has been since this ban went into effect just a few months ago.
Yeah,
because, you know, for myself, you know, learning about this issue, fairly recently, that was my, and learning about this 2-year ban that was about to go into effect, you know, that was my number one concern was, you know, are they really going to be able to enforce this, right? Because all of the Tatuaba fishing that we have been talking about, leading up to this 2-year ban period, I mean, that was all illegal fishing, right? Because the Tatuaba is considered endangered. So, you know, looking at this from an outsider, you know, you would think, well, what effect is a 2-year ban really going to have if most of the fishing that's impacting vaquita is already illegal fishing? You just say, yeah, it's illegal. It has been illegal, and now it's even more illegal. You know, I mean, so this, a lot of folks have been talking about this 2-year ban and how important it is, but I mean, it's really the step up and the commitment to enforcement from all these agencies within the Mexican government that you were talking about, that's probably the most important step that's been taken.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very, as you said, it's even more illegal, if you can say that, to to fish vaquita. I mean, to fish the Tatuaba. And enforcement news are pretty positive so far. The only gill that it's allowed right now is for Gulf Corbina. And they do it by rodeo or encircle the the fish. And from what we know, that doesn't kill vaquitas, but it's important to enforce that these gill nets are not used in other fishery when there's no corvina season. So that should be important to consider. So again, the permanent gill net ban, it's important to promote, and it's important to have developed the alternative gear and have all these economics considerations. But an important thing that I want to mention is that in this 2-year emergency gill net, and as I said, it's welcome, I think, worldwide, we strongly emphasize that during this period of 2 years, it's completely insufficient to determine if there are any effects of the current 2-year ban to gill nets in vaquita abundance. And I mention this because we are already hearing from some fishermen and some officers that they will have this 2-year ban will demonstrate that it's not fishing that kills vaquita, because after the 2-year ban, we will see that the population is very small. So again, there's no time for the vaquita to recover, and we don't have the scientific tools to detect 3 or 4 vaquitas in a couple of years. I mean, it's impossible.
Right. Absolutely. It's definitely important that, yeah, to remember that even though this is a really important step that's been taken towards the recovery of the vaquita, that it is not, and it is not a solution to the issue. It's sort of a stopgap measure to allow you and other folks involved in vaquita recovery to figure out what that long-term measure really is, or how to make this gill net ban permanent. That is absolutely an important point to make. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you think is important to include in this conversation here?
Yeah, I think one of the issues that it's going to happen very soon is that the government has decided to fund a new vaquita survey. So we will estimate how population size of vaquita 2015 this year. We will start in September, mid-September, and probably finish by early December. It's about 64 days at sea. And I think this is a interesting moment, because the results of this survey will have an impact, I think, in future conservation actions, or in the very near future. And so this is a big effort, and it's a joint survey with researchers from the Southwest Fishery Science Center and my group. And we will have observers, which are people that dedicate their lives to identify marine mammals in the water. It's not that easy. So we will have observers from US, Europe, and Mexico to help. It will be, we will have a very large ship that could house several researchers and observers, and then we will combine that with the acoustic survey in shallow waters. We have sent our proposal to review by the world experts, and they all agree this is the best option to come with an estimate of vaquita. It's going to be a small population. We will not see many vaquitas. It will be difficult. But I think this is a good measure by the government to have a baseline to start working in future measures. I think the situation is really bad now, but we need that survey is going to have an important impact.
Great. Well, yeah, that is definitely good to hear. And I'm actually hoping to use this survey this coming fall as an opportunity to get down to that region myself, to get a little bit of footage for our documentary that we're working on about the vaquita. So I'm looking forward to that. It's been fantastic, Lorenzo, to hear about sort of the history and the progression of vaquita conservation over the past several decades from you. And I definitely learned a few interesting things through this conversation. And yeah, even though, like you say, these solutions that are sort of in the works, in progress, you know, this 2-year ban, this survey that's about to happen, you know, these are not sort of end solutions. They're not going to solve the problem of Vaquita recovery, but they're important steps forward, right? And they're steps that needed to be taken in order to give the Vaquita a chance at survival. And so even though we don't have that final solution to saving the Vaquita, it's really good to see that these measures are being implemented, that the enforcement is being effective, and you know, basically that we have a little bit of time, right, to figure out what that sort of what that final step will look like, and how we'll ultimately be able to bring this species back from the brink of extinction.
Yeah, that's true. It's I think it's important times. It's incredible where we are now. I mean, in the conservation measures, but also in the dramatic decline of Vaquita. So we don't have much time to save Vaquita. It has to be now, or it will never be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been fantastic chatting with you, Lorenzo. And yeah, your perspective is hugely valued by us. And all of the work that you've been doing over the course of the past several decades to help save the Vaquita, thank you for that. And yeah, I look forward to continuing to chat with you in the future, you know, maybe having you on the podcast for future episodes to sort of get updates on how the recovery effort is going as time progresses. And yeah, thanks a lot for everything you do. And it was great having this conversation with you.
Well, thank you for your interest. I think it's like Sean and you, people who have a key role to disseminate what we are doing, and people realize that there's a unique species at the brink of extinction, that it's very close to the U.S., not that far away, and that this could be a turning point for Vaquita conservation, and to probably or hopefully would also have an impact in other areas and other species that are being bycut by fishing gear.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's leave it off on that note, hoping that this is a turning point for the Vaquita. Well, thanks a lot. Good chatting with you, Lorenzo.
Thanks, Matthew. Have a good day.
All right. That was our interview with Lorenzo Rojas Bracho from the National Institute of Ecology and Climate Change in Mexico. This interview was fascinating for me, not just because of the information that Lorenzo shared about the Vaquita and its recovery efforts, but because of the insight into how conservation efforts work in Mexico. While there are certainly many similarities that we can draw to our system here in the U.S., there are also some important differences, and it will be important to keep these in mind as we move forward with Vaquita recovery efforts. This will be our final Vaquita-themed episode for a while. We'll continue to interview various Vaquita experts on the show over the course of our 3-year production schedule for our new film, Souls of the Vermilion Sea, but this first Vaquita-themed month is close to its end. Which means, of course, that our Kickstarter campaign in support of our new documentary about the Vaquita is also coming to a close. The campaign ends on June 30th. Just 6 days from the release of this episode. So if you haven't gotten that pledge in, now is your final opportunity. There are still lots of amazing reward items available, so be sure to check it out, share it around, and make a pledge. You can find the link to our Kickstarter campaign on the show notes page for this episode at wildlensinc.org/EOC30. That's wildlensinc.org/EOC30. This episode was produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky. Our Vaquita theme song is by Ben Mirren.